Yeah, thank you. So yeah, the my talk is called Hashtag Childism on the Contemporary Significance of a Seriously Playful Label. And I'd like to obviously begin by expressing my gratitude to Annette Hellman for reaching out to me and showing a keen interest in integrating the childist perspective in the work being done here at Global Childhoods. And it's really an honor for me to be here. It's remarkable and also very reassuring because the journey has been very long and challenging, not only because not only because I consciously philosophize in and about privileged white life worlds like Scandinavia, but also because I philosophize through childhood studies, which, as I experience, it's a field that has a rather warped and distorted relationship to philosophy, even if it were only Western philosophy. And with words like warped and distorted, I'm referring in a sense to, the bent neck of a guitar, which puts the strings a bit out of alignment in a way that the quality of the sound is bound to create dissonance than the resonance. And because there's a growing use of vocabulary like ontology, epistemology, metaphysics, ethics, aesthetics, and such over the past 2 decades. In childhood studies. And I see that there is a bit of a distinction between global childhoods as a field and childhood studies and so on. But there is a growing use of the terms without what I sense as much reflection on what is what is really meant when one uses these words and what kind of colonial histories are reproduced when you use the words in the way that you do. And a rather curious related phenomenon is that philosophers of childhood in the young history of childhood studies have played a marginal role. So in the inception of the field itself, philosophers of childhood were marginalized. And even today, philosophers of childhood, white or not, male or not, heteronormative or not, will most likely find themselves on the periphery of the field, witnessing philosophical commitments about children and childhood flying around haphazardly, argumentations being developed with sustained conceptual unclarity and a kind of a lack of awareness of one's own philosophical commitments that are implicit in the kind of intellectual efforts one makes. So I do have a lot of appreciation for Global Childhoods Network for inviting not one but two philosophers to give a keynote at this network conference. It's unusual, in my humble opinion. And I'm not sure whether it was a conscious decision, but it's surely an acknowledgement of the place of philosophical awareness in the development of rigorous academic work. So in my most recent article titled What Takes Us So Long, The Philosophical Poverty of Childhood Studies and Education, I concur and agree with my fellow philosopher Marek Cesar and his co-authors that philosophical commitments about children and childhood entail larger metaphysical considerations about the nature of being, reality, and existence, and they influence the everydayness of policy making and implementation. So our philosophical commitments about children and childhood also influence research and teaching processes in higher education, as well as in our daily lives. In other words, metaphysical considerations are not a matter of intellectual neatness, separated from the empirical. And they're no longer mysterious concepts from outer space that have nothing to do with our empirical life worlds. And I would add to our empirical life worlds where the awareness of white colonial legacies, especially in privileged contexts like Scandinavia and Europe, have to somehow have their due space in research. The metaphor of the white child, after all, has been central to ascribing a primitive, irrational, uncivilized, underdeveloped otherness to former colonies. So when you see philosophers like Kant, you know, they're using the metaphor of the child to talk about their relationships to Tahitians or indigenous people, but the metaphor is about the white child that they are imposing somewhere else. It's been used to refer to indigenous peoples also, you know, in the Scandinavian context, like the Sami peoples of Scandinavia. The political philosopher Toby Rollo's work is worth, you know, his examination of the intersections of racism and adultism are mention worthy here. And this intersection of racism and adultism, I think, has a special relevance for the development of childism as a transformative perspective towards including children and childhood into our worldviews of what it could mean to be human in both scholarship and society. Childism then could be grasped as a perspective that broadens our horizons of the relationship between marginalization and socio-philosophical justice. Scholarship at the overlaps of philosophy of education, decoloniality, and childism points to the exclusion of childhood and related oppressed positionalities in the Western philosophy of education and its subdisciplines, the philosophy of childhood, for example. And the standpoint of questioning, that, you know, the position from where our questions emerge and the way we raise questions, because they're two different things. That's where our philosophical commitments are nested, you know. And I will come to the standpoint of questioning shortly. Because that would be the crux of what I want to say today, and I hope that you take from my talk. But first, I would like to say a few words about the contemporary significance of childism as a label in its childhood study sense of the term, because there is an internal debate about the word childism. You know, should it be used like to mean something oppressive like racism, or in its transformative sense like feminism, but in the childhood studies sense, and I agree to this argument that, you know, why should we use the word child to describe something adults do to children? So in that sense, I'm also using it in the transformative sense like feminism and decolonialism. So my understanding of the contemporary world now, that's best described through what the Norwegian anthropologist Thomas Hyland Eriksen calls overheating. Overheating is not only about the climate crisis, but rather an entanglement of climate, cultural, and the economic crises of the early 21st century. So it's a metaphorical and a literal expression which describes the compounded term Anthropocene neoliberalism. Where the tendency at micro, meso, and macro levels is towards upscaled, accelerated growth with no upper limit. Overheating describes an acceleration of acceleration, and in physics, speed and heat are related. You know, so when you drive at a high speed and, you know, the engine heats up or something, there's an inbuilt system that will tell you, you know, you have to stop, you have to slow down a bit. Or when it gets cold and we rub our hands to generate heat, after a point, the body will tell you it's too much, you know, stop. But there's no such inbuilt thermostat in this overheated era that tells us, you know, where is that upper limit of growth? How fast or slow could we actually push this? in this era, there, in our own industry, I think it's pragmatic to acknowledge that academia in the 21st century is also, you know, it's a billion-dollar publication industry, even though we might disagree with the state of affairs or we never actually see the money that our products are bringing in. It's a different economy, but it is a production, you know, it's an industry where competitive publication points for academics and credit points for students is what is driving, like, ruling logic of higher education. And in primary and, you know, secondary education, you know, which would also concern children and youth, there is an upscaling of competition, which children and young people bear the brunt of, let alone, you know, teachers and parents as well. And then outside the academic bubble, especially also, you know, the academic bubble in Scandinavia here, there's a rise of right-wing extremism, economic crises like inflation, mass extinction of species, along with other climate change-related disastrous impacts. And these are all symptoms of overheating at a global scale. And Erikson's broader conclusion is that an appropriate response to the era of overheating would be to slow down, scale down, and cool down. And I strongly agree with this. So from a childist perspective, I've argued that children and childhood offer adults the orientation and possibility to do just that, to slow down, scale down, and cool down. And in encountering children and childhood from an adult positionality in a world where adult-centric meanings form the norm somehow entails laying open our taken-for-granted world to question from another standpoint. You know, I call this unstiffening our conceptual muscles. And the most, you know, mundane meanings are challenged. So why do we sit at a table and not on a table or under a table? You know, such questions, they challenge larger cultural norms. They can challenge our sense of identity, you know, because we sit in a certain way to perform our adulthood and roles. But with older children, for example, Greta Thunberg's school strikes, really like macro level norms can be directly challenged. So the questions that are raised really hit those. So why go to school for a future when there is no future? So to engage with questions like these, to answer these questions, one has to slow down, scale down, and cool down, to take a step back and enter those negotiations of meanings that children are bringing to the table. And a whole different standpoint of questioning opens up, and with it, a new range of possible ways of understanding what else could be. When we welcome questions from the standpoint of children and childhood in an adult-centric world. Now, one of the key areas explored by childhood studies is children's agency and childhoods as non-universal social constructions. And the field itself emerged as a response to the marginalization of children in theory and society. Childism, as what John Wall has described as a third wave in childhood studies, flows further in this direction, asking, among other things, what is it that we can learn from children and childhood agency? What could social and theoretical transformation look like if it had to include children and childhood alongside other marginalized groups? So, you know, it extends, in a way, an intersectional project or the projects of social justice, historical social justice. In other words, childism further explores the possibilities that have opened up as a result of childhood studies scholarship over the past three, four decades. And its applications are not limited to childhood studies insofar as it is a perspective. And it could expand other critical projects such as feminism and decolonialism, which I will also shortly come to. So, you know, back to this contemporary 21st century era of overheating, such a perspective is of particular philosophical significance, especially, and I emphasize the ethical dimension here, especially in privileged contexts, whether one has inherited their place in these or earned it, you know, because we live off resources borrowed from future generations globally. Childism then is not only about our relationship to present children and childhood, but our relationship also to those who are yet to come. So it requires developing the ability to balance the value of the here and now, this immediacy, with longer temporal considerations. So a question that I began asking as a result of my exchanges on childism and overheating with Thomas Hyland Erikson is, how can we learn to be good ancestors of the future in the present? Young school strikers and climate activists, especially from privileged contexts, have been a driving factor for me over the past years because of the way that they have used their privileged positions to challenge norms and bring the intergenerational dimension of the climate, you know, of climate injustice into political debates. So Greta Thunberg, you know, went on school strikes and challenged what it means to be a school pupil in an overheated adult-centric world because she could afford to do so. And that is something adults, especially those in additionally, you know, power positions, can learn from. So if one can afford to challenge the norm, you know, raise a different question, choose a slightly different lifestyle choice, it's probably a good idea to do it because, you know, future generations will have better references to work with than what currently is upscaled and out there. And it's been argued that the historical feminist struggles of Greta's sociopolitical context contributed to the possibility for her to have and act with that political awareness that she did. And I do not doubt that the Swedish white feminist history enabled the possibility of a young girl child like Greta Thunberg to go out and you know, strike adult structures in 2018, not to forget that her resistance already began at a much younger age, at micro context, so at home, at school. So this was going on. However, Greta's argument as a child went beyond feminism because it explicitly addressed structural adultism and brought the dimension of age to the forefront of social and scholarly status quo. And this dimension, especially of minor age, in relational position to adulthood, an intergenerational positionality, we might say, has been a theoretical option for feminist thought. It's not the raison d'etre, it's not the reason feminism came to being. And the dimension of a intergenerational relational positioning that the childist perspective entails is one of the main reasons that I couldn't settle for a feminist label. My own life journey, in fact, that I exist on this planet thanks to very liberal parents in India, to a large extent, is, you know, among other considerations, a consequence of feminist socio-political ideals from both the so-called West and non-West. Because the Indian society is one of the prime sites that contributed to the development of the anthropological concept of female infanticide or feticide. So that is the killing of female babies and fetuses because the socioeconomic worth is not as high in that society of female babies as compared to male babies. So not only did my parents keep the female baby, they decided not to have any more babies despite social pressures to have a boy, and invested their modest, you know, middle class resources in raising me, knowing very well that you know, they had to let me go to another land, to another context for that upbringing to make any sense. And that's, it's incredible. You know, I'm very grateful for this. And my university education in the Indian context also ended up being free because, you know, the state of Maharashtra where I grew up, they support, you know, girls' university education and so on. So there was this structural support. In Germany, which is also, you know, home to me, it was the Bavarian government's very gender equality program where they invested very strategically in preparing early career female scholars like me for an academic career in Europe. Now, this is a lot of money being invested into one human being, okay? And that I can choose to be child-free because I love children very much and I want to focus on developing childism is also thanks to feminist history, no doubt. So there are just a few examples of how I have and I do benefit unapologetically from progressive socio-political advancements feminism made globally. And I have gratitude and respect for all forms of feminism. Nevertheless, my own philosophical questioning and political concerns since childhood have to do more with being a child in an adult-centric world than a patriarchal one. While patriarchy is in fact about an adult pater or father, which makes adultism an important axis of oppression for feminists to examine, you see, matriarchy is also about an adult mother. So either way, adultism can go conveniently unnoticed in this power struggle between genders and sexes. And feminism, especially white feminism, taken to its logical extremes, can well lead to individualism, but childism can only be worked out through its anchoredness in deep interdependent or a deep shared agency, as you pointed out. And there are intergenerational values there that are respectful towards those upon whom we also depend on to realize social identities that bring existential meaning and hope into our lives. You know, roles like father, mother, uncle, aunt, granddad, grandmom, teachers, childhood researchers, and such. But they all depend on children and that they exist. So there's a lot that there's a dependence that goes the other way as well, which is not the same, of course, as how children depend on us, but there is an interdependence. And highly individualistic expressions of feminism are also in deep political tension with children and childhood. And they can violate rights of children to have equal human consideration. So I'm thinking of Ylva Ågren's documentation of this phenomenon of Scandinavian women on Instagram who use babies as digital capital for pushing up their influencer status, a kind of show of some kind of ideal motherhood, you know. Feminist projects can expand as by integrating the childist lens. So a recent example of work that emerges from a feminist project, but is I would say it's a childist project, is Penny Weiss's latest book titled Feminist Reflections on Childhood, A History and Call to Action. Weiss doesn't herself use the label childist, and I should probably inquire why. But her book is a recognition of children's contribution to her life as a feminist scholar. So it's a very different, you know, point, a feminist project that, and it's an option, right? I mean, you could take this option, you wouldn't take this option. So the standpoint of questioning and theorizing comes from an epistemological humility where an adult scholar works out what can we learn from children and childhood. So Shanet Sandhal's research is an example where using the label of childism explicitly opens up analytical possibilities in theorizing citizenship, which other labels could not have afforded her. She couldn't have worked that whole thing out without explicitly saying this is a childist analysis. Decolonial and post-colonial scholars of childhood, so no one gets away now, okay? Decolonial and post-colonial scholars of childhood, especially scholars of color, in my view, have an equal philosophical responsibility, if not bigger, to confront their negligence of adultism in their scholarship, scholarly engagements. Because once again, what Toby Rollo is showing, the figure of the child has been central to racist and colonial projects. This infantilization, that we talk about. And as adults, we react a lot to being infantilized, but, where is that idea coming from? So we read post-colonial scholarship to make sense of children and childhood, treating scholars like Gayatri Spivak as unquestioned authorities to analyze children and childhood without asking, could it be that post-colonial scholarship, and as a result, decolonial scholarship is also blind to adultism. And I doubt whether any decolonial project can be realized without addressing adultism, given that, and I keep mentioning Toby Rollo again, the figure of the child has been central to coloniality. So nationalist projects, in former colonies like India, they depend on children and childhood to realize, their perverse upper caste Brahmin supremacist dreams or agendas of creating some absurd idea of a white Hindu motherland, which they probably got from Hitler's, German fatherland kind of ideas. They do it through education and children's upbringing through. So when I first came across the word childism as a doctoral researcher in its childhood study sense of the term, it was like finally finding a word to begin articulating a nascent philosophical perspective that I was already traveling for many years in relation to different children and childhoods who were nurturing me. And as I mentioned a bit earlier in my talk as well, since childhood, my philosophical and political concerns have had to do with my place in an adultist world. And over the years, some of the most inspiring and eye-opening moments that helped me blossom have come from children. And at the same time, it also gave me the possibility to start grasping systemic and interpersonal barriers, the intergenerational injustices breeding through leftover, embers of colonial that are still burning and contributing to the overheating of this world, where, as I said, we live off the expense of future generations. And the point I'm trying to emphasize in my work is that addressing adultism and collectively exploring the possibility of childist transformation in scholarship and society is not only about children's interests, but also those of adults. Because one cannot limit the self without limiting the other, and vice versa. Like you limit the other, you have to limit yourself. So as feminist history will also show, women gaining rights to work, for example, opened the possibility for men to take on caregiving roles. And it's okay to be a father and love the child and do things at home and so on while the woman goes out and works. So it did kind of liberate both sides. So at least in theory, there's a mutual liberation that is entailed there. My decolonial argument in this paper I mentioned, which Marek kindly referenced, is that, for example, even with racism, it also has backlashes for the racist. So now we are all into, we need diverse epistemologies and plural logics, and let's get the indigenous worldviews, but processes like Norwegianization wiped out Sami knowledge systems, and now neither, you know, the Sami struggle to find that knowledge, the Norwegians struggle to make sense of it. So there's been a backlash also epistemologically for the racists and the colonizers, you know, so it's a lose-lose for both sides. And all this knowledge would have been very useful and pragmatic right now in responding to the overheating crisis. The same would apply, I think, to adult-child relationships if we worked through childist standpoints. And such a standpoint, as in any standpoint, is in the kind of questions we raise. So what does it entail to ask questions from a childist standpoint? And this is a question that I wish to collectively share with this network and its guests, you know, not just in the next days, but over the coming years. And I hope that this is a question that the different groups, you know, would also be motivated to take up by examining, you know, what is the point of departure of the questions that I am asking? You know, is there and is there a kind of an adult centricness still in my question itself? And arriving at questions that are responsive to and recognizing both the marginalization but also the agency of children and childhood in a way that perhaps brings forth the deficit on the adult side of the scale, you know, of the side into the equation, that is very challenging. Recognizing the adult ideological viewpoint in our own questions is not an easy task either, but it requires attention because, you know, research agendas are primarily defined by research questions. And I mean, you know, epistemologically and philosophically, because of course, who pays for research and so on? I mean, this is that you pointed that out, that matters, but the research itself will be driven by certain questions. And it can actually be quite a conflicting process to be able, even if you arrive at the questions, to actually raise them. Is another story altogether. So the struggle comes at all steps. Think of, you know, how both philosophical and scientific progress is, it entails, among other things, an evolution in the kind of questions that are asked. So if one thinks of questions like a torch, your answers, the possible answers, are already worked out. I mean, you'll have to see them, but the question is going to demarcate what the possible answers are that are going to come. So they have a pivotal role in facilitating our roles as researchers, which is to be able to see something as something. You know, that's the perspectives that we bring in through our engagement with life worlds. So to conclude, I'm basically welcoming, inviting, and requesting your support to develop childism through examining, you know, our questions, so that we can perhaps leave something valuable behind for future generations of scholars to come. And I think, you know, and hope to get closer to the possibility of contributing to the emergence of more child responsive societies. Yeah. So thank you.